Bristol Banter, your geeky conversational podcast. We are your hosts,
Jenny
and Rory Bristol. Join us today as we chat about libraries for episode 2. Okay, our Did You Know segment today concerns super glue. I like super glue. I think it's pretty freaking neat.
It's useful.
Yes, it fixes everything, except when it doesn't. And there are some really interesting things behind that. Did you know that it is combustible when combined with cotton?
I'm not surprised. It has fumes.
Yes.
Very distinct fumes.
When you put it with natural materials like cotton or leather, it can ignite those materials.
But you can set cotton on fire anyway on its own.
Well, it's exothermic. Like, you don't need fire to do it. It will create the fire.
Oh, it will ignite itself.
Yes.
It will not just allow it to be ignited.
Right. It will start. It can start a fire. This is why, when somebody's like, "Oh, can I just use super glue instead of Freycheck?" The answer is always no, because Freycheck is not the same thing as super glue.
It's kind of close, but
they're not actually even the same classification of chemical.
I see some science experiments in our future.
Yeah, that would be cool. Hey kids, let's set a shirt on fire. Don't actually do that at home, please. So, other things that super glue specifically is used for. Medicinal purposes. It was first used for mending bones and hides in animals and veterinary practices.
It works well for human skin.
Yes, but it's the only thing you can use to repair a crack in a tortoise shell, for example, because nothing else works or is toxic.
No duct tape?
No duct tape for the turtle.
You're saying it's not toxic?
It is not corrosive in and of itself.
Okay.
So for the animal, it's not going to...
They can't get their tongue back there to lick it.
Right. They're not going to ingest it, and it's topical stuff. So, you know, I wouldn't squirt it into a turtle's shell, you know, if it cracked. Put it over the top, though, to reinforce it, maybe. What year do you think the FDA approved a super glue product for human use?
Like for just humans able to use it or to use on the humans?
To use on human patients.
1985?
1998.
Really?
With Dermabond, the brand Dermabond, produced one that they were able to, you know, pitch and sell to the FDA as a good product for using on people.
Like for stitching up wounds and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. They didn't use it before 1998?
Not on humans. Not with FDA approval.
Wow, I thought it was older than that.
Yep. And it is actually more hygienic than stitches. It leaves a less noticeable scar. And it heals instantly. It burns like a son of a, which I found out the hard way one time after having an injury on my face. But it hurts really, really bad for like 2 seconds. And then you're done. Where stitches, they get tighter and tighter, and they hurt more and more over time.
And they can leave marks as well.
Right.
On themselves.
You get the Frankenstein scars.
Didn't it hurt more than 2 seconds? I was watching.
Oh, no. That was multiple applications. He did it several times.
I know, but he would apply it to your face and then stand back and wait, and then you would wince and cringe for like a minute, and then he would do it again.
Yeah, it just sucked. Mostly that was, I'm not looking forward to the next batch, so I was making faces to prolong.
Oh.
I didn't want him to do it again, so I just kept moving until I was like, okay, I have my courage back. Let's do this again. But yeah, I was terrified. I was like, you're going to do it again, aren't you? And he's like, yep. And I'm like, crap.
Well, it did minimize scarring.
Yeah.
Compared with stitches.
Well, I don't actually know, because I have a beard over that, and I have ever since. I've never shaved my beard since that injury. Because I really don't want to know if there's a crazy scar under there. You can also use it to repair damage to your hands. If you're like rock climbing and scrape the skin on your hands, you can use it topically to make a effective healing seal over your skin.
Is that like new skin or something?
No, new skin is its own thing.
Yeah, they have all these like skin mm-hmm. protective.
But rock climbers and like adventure hikers and stuff will take super glue, and then if they like tear off a finger pad, like, because that's a thing, they just super glue it, and then they have this rough thing. You can also use it on your fingers to obliterate your fingerprint.
We're not suggesting you do that.
No, but if you're, you know, just for fun, science experiment, you can completely mask your fingerprint using it. And it doesn't leave a residue behind. If you do it with, like, regular glue, that leaves a residue behind. So, anyway,
Good to know.
I think that one's pretty dang cool.
The more you know.
The biggest thing with it is that it's just super fast acting. It's exothermic, so it uses itself up pretty quickly because, of course, it produces heat, and then the heat is a catalyst, and so its bonding process is pretty rapid. It can be used to almost instantly seal skin to skin, including eyelids and fingers and things like that.
I have glued my fingers together before.
Yes. If you just leave it, it will unbind over time to your skin because your skin will slough off the cells underneath the glue. And you could speed that up by like putting oil on it and things like that, mineral oil and whatnot. But otherwise, you're just stuck peeling it off from the surface. You can even use super glue to fill a space. You definitely don't do that to like a hole in your arm. But you can use it to fill a space. You put baking soda in the hole and then the super glue, and it kind of foams and fills the space up, which is pretty cool.
It reacts with the baking soda?
Yeah.
And becomes like a
leavened plastic
of super glueness.
Yeah. And it can fill it up. You can use it to glue live rock together and coral. You can also use it to fix things in your aquarium or in the ocean or whatever, because it is fast acting and exothermic. You can apply it to coral under the water to repair a coral shelf. You would need a metric ton of the stuff to like repair like a reef, but you could, you know, if you're trying to minimize human damage to an environment and, you know, you're doing construction in the area and something breaks something, you can go back and repair it and put it all back together, and voila, you have your coral shelf back.
Sounds pretty versatile.
Yes, it does a lot of things. It's like duct tape, but liquid, and it goes away on its own, mostly. I like it that way.
Good for temporary repairs.
Yeah, and you can use it for all kinds of things. It's used in cosmetics for like fingernails. It's used in woodworking to fill voids and cracks inside the wood, or to use on furniture to repair cracks. It's one of the few things that that can bond smooth surfaces together, because most glues need things to bind to on both surfaces.
And on to our main segment of the show, libraries. What is the largest library in the world?
The largest current one? Probably the Library of Congress.
Are you only saying that because you know that I was looking it up?
No, but it would either be the Library of Congress or the Vatican has an enormous, enormous library. Like, it's the size of a couple of houses. And then my next bet would probably be Britain's. The London Library is pretty big.
I'm pretty sure the British Library was number two, though I didn't really research that. But yes, the Library of Congress is the world's largest library currently.
Other than the internet.
Yeah, but I mean the one with like actual physical books and photographs and materials.
But thanks to the internet, the whole planet's the library now. I mean, seriously, anybody can be the resource.
Isn't that a Doctor Who thing where the whole planet was a library?
Yes.
Is that the one where Donna got saved?
Was it Donna Noble?
Donna Noble has left the library. Donna Noble has been saved.
Okay, so it was Donna Noble? Well, that's the first time he meets River Song.
Right.
And it's the last time she sees him, because that's the episode she dies in.
That was the last one, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so sad.
It was so sad. I really want to watch them backwards so that we can see it from her timeline. Because, seriously, could you imagine meeting the person you're going to marry for the first time when it's the last time he'll have seen you?
Yeah. You can't grow together as a couple.
You don't get to grow together. You get to grow inversely. So,
that would be heartbreaking.
Yeah, and when she meets him in her first time, she's barely older than a teenager. She's a very young adult, and she, you know, saves his life by giving up her regenerative abilities for the rest of her life, and becomes the actress, the image we know as River Song, in that episode, and it's the first time she's met him, and forevermore, she's chasing his last moments.
We digress a bit.
We digress.
Back to the Library of Congress.
Back to the Library of Congress. Woo!
So what is the Library of Congress? Why do we have it? It is the research library for Congress. That's how it started out.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's basically our nation's national library. It's, you know, considered the resource of the nation. But they also have sections for Congress specifically to go do their research.
Don't they keep their congressional records there as well?
Probably.
Because they're public record.
I'm sure they have copies of them. I'm sure they have copies there, but they probably also have them in the Capitol building where they can reference them a little more directly. But I remember learning when I was a kid that every time a book got published, two copies of it went to the Library of Congress, which is a fact I hadn't encountered since I learned this as a kid. And so I was like, is that true? Am I remembering wrong? Did somebody tell me wrong? My research showed me that apparently in the late 1800s, the Library of Congress got the right to have two copies of all copyrighted works, including books, maps, illustrations, and diagrams that were printed in the U.S. So they may not necessarily have two copies of every book, but they have a right to two copies of every book, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And again, from my research, they of the ones they receive, they probably hold on to about 2/3 of them, which means they're having to grow all the time.
Yeah.
So the Library of Congress is, pretty obviously, located in Washington, D.C., and it's well worth a visit if you're in the area. It's full of exhibits and activities, and it is constructed with gorgeous architecture. You can also get a reader's card, which allows you into the reading room, where you can look at materials that are housed in the library, or at least the ones that are accessible to the public.
Like the ones you can't check out?
Well, you can't check out any of them. We can't check out any of them.
Oh, okay.
Certain members of the government can get permission to check out certain ones. But for us, we're only allowed to go in and look at stuff. And for some of them, you have to wear white gloves. And some of them you just look at, you know, if you were looking at something that wasn't an antique.
That's pretty cool. Don't they have book handlers as well?
What do you mean?
Like, say, some senator really needs to read a piece of work that's like 150 years old and wants to look at the original piece. Don't they have somebody who handles the book for them? Isn't that a thing?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. I mean, you want whoever it is to be responsible with it.
Yes.
So if it's really in bad condition or deteriorated, mm-hmm. I'm sure they would make sure that somebody who knew what they were doing
was managing
the book. So the Library of Congress is our national library, but it also houses collections from all parts of the world. It has materials in 470 different languages, and 2/3 of the books that it gets each year aren't even in English.
Really?
Yeah, so it is not just our national library, but it holds on to a lot of materials from all over the world, so it's protecting a lot of culture.
Yeah. I wonder if they back up any of that, like, as data.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, a lot of it is available on their website, but I don't know what kind of percentage, because some of it is really tricky to scan.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a question for you. How much was the first librarian of Congress paid in 1802?
In 1802, $12 a month.
His name was John J. Beckley, and he made $2 a day. So that's about $60 a month.
Wow.
He was also required to serve as the clerk for the House of Representatives, so he probably earned his money.
Oh, okay, yeah, because just being the librarian is one thing, but serving as the clerk for Congress? Holy crap.
Oh, just the House of Representatives.
Oh, just the House of Representatives. Okay.
Most of the original collection of books in the library, after it was created, had been destroyed during the War of 1812 by the British, who set fire to it in 1814. But then the library bought Thomas Jefferson's personal book collection, which contained 6,487 books. And when I visited Library of Congress in 2011, there was an exhibit surrounding this collection. But there's a lot more drama to come with his collection, because another fire destroyed many of the books in 1851, including about 2/3 of Jefferson's books, unfortunately.
Dang.
But, you know, since then, they've tried to replace the burned copies from other places, and in 2008, workers had found replacements for all but 300 of Jefferson's books after they'd labored for 10 years. So they worked really hard to recreate the collection.
Holy smokes. Could you imagine 10 years hunting down books and not necessarily knowing what all of them are called even?
I'm sure they had them written down. Yeah, unless that a list or also. Something.
Yeah.
But I think that would be a really fun project.
Well, I imagine they had to go to local libraries all over the country.
Antique bookstores.
Yeah. And international trade, because mm-hmm. I can guarantee you his books weren't all in English or right. all American.
He spent a lot of time in France. Mm-hmm. So they had probably had to go to France. Oh, darn. Road trip to France.
Well, then they didn't have airplanes, so it was quite the voyage to go to France.
No, but, you know, in 2008, you know, when they were doing it more recently, they were getting them. You could still travel to France by airplane.
Yeah.
But only the higher-ups in the government can check materials out from the library, but the rest of us can still enjoy the collections. And if you can't make it to the library in person, they have a really fantastic website. It's at www.loc.gov. You could spend years on there and not see everything on the website. But I recommend it for teachers, students, people researching anything, people who love to learn on their own. You can search the collections by keyword, by era, by type of product. If you love history at all, it's kind of a big rabbit hole. Here's another question.
Okay.
How much seed money did President John Adams's Act of Congress provide for stocking the shelves of the newly established Library of Congress in 1800, along with housing them? So how much money did he say, here's some money, buy some books, and figure out a way to house them, and here's your budget? How much did he give them?
$12,000.
$5,000. But that was 1800. So with the $5,000, they bought 740 books and 3 maps that they'd ordered from London, and they were housed in the new Capitol building. And by comparison, Congress paid $23,950 for Jefferson's collection of books. Of course, there were many more books in his collection than they bought originally. But I just think that's really cool. Another question. How many books or other materials does the Library of Congress hold currently?
Oh, probably at a couple million books. A metric ton. What?
A metric ton. More than 160 million items.
160 million?
Items of different kinds. On about 838 miles of bookshelves.
838 miles. Wow. How big is the library?
It's big. They hold more than 37 million catalog books and other printed materials, 69 million manuscripts. They have a rough draft of the Declaration of Independence, a Gutenberg Bible, which is one of only 3 vellum copies that are in perfect condition.
It's in perfect condition?
Yes, and I've seen it. It's beautiful.
Oh my God. Talk about a book that is only handled by professionals.
Yes, it's in a case and with special lighting and everything. It has over 1 million U.S. government publications, 1 million world newspaper issues representing over 3 centuries of time.
Wow.
Over 120,000 comic book issues.
120,000
comic book issues.
Ha!
5.3 million maps, and the list goes just goes on and on.
5.3 million maps. That is a heck of a lot of maps.
This is the library. You know, if you had to say there was a library, this would be it. It's a happy place. Okay, the Library of Congress also serves as the base for the U.S. Copyright Office, which kind of makes sense because when you write something, you hold copyright to it, and the copyrights of books and materials are very intricately connected to library holdings and things like that.
Yeah. Are they also the home of the patent office?
I wouldn't think so. I didn't come across that. But patents, I mean, they probably have copies of patents,
mm-hmm.
but the patent office is probably separate because it's more having to do with inventions than a record of something, if that makes sense.
It does. Does the Library of Congress designate the classification of a book for shelves in public libraries?
Not in most public libraries. The library, I didn't research this one extensively because I didn't choose to, but the Library of Congress classification system is usually in research libraries and university libraries, and most public libraries and school libraries use the Dewey Decimal System.
Oh, okay. Because I had that in college. The Library of the Congress designated where our books were in our college library.
Right.
Which was very distracting because I was used to the Dewey Decimal System and I knew where to find things in that system. And so I had to learn a whole new system to do my research in college. And I did a lot of stinking research projects in college.
I think the reason they use the Library of Congress one is because university libraries are considered research libraries. Mm-hmm. Library of Congress, kind of a research library, whereas your local public library, that's where you're going to go check out the latest novel or books for your kids or a book on mm-hmm. how to fix your sink or something like that. It's not necessarily the best place to do hard
research.
Deep research. So they just stayed with the Dewey Decimal System.
Okay, so speaking of the biggest library in the world, which was burned more than one time, the Library of Alexandria is probably one of my favorite cultural myths based on history.
How is it a myth?
Well, the fire of Alexandria, as people think of it, you know, they just think, oh, well, the whole thing burned down. It's a complete myth. It didn't happen that way at all. It was in Alexandria and...
In Egypt.
In Egypt, yes. And the thing was that they put together this enormous, enormous library, right? All of the things. They made an actual, genuine, what we look at as a library. But there was just like in a completely different model from what we do with ours. So instead of taking a copy of someone's book, they took the book and gave the person back a copy. Even if it was their diary or their own maps, if a ship docked at the Library of Alexandria or in Alexandria in general, the library required them to submit all written materials to the library. And if they deemed them useful, they confiscated the books and gave the owners a copy of the books.
Which they probably had to wait a long time to get.
Yes.
Depending on the length, it would take a really long time to copy it. And then there might be mistakes in the copy.
Right.
Certainly wouldn't be in their own handwriting.
Right. And because they used all of the papyrus to make their scrolls for the library, they are the people, the Library of Alexandria is the reason we have other kinds of paper products. Because they bogarted all the materials for scrolls, and so and it included all the farmed materials, like all the raw materials, they all went to the library, and so people had to come up with new paper making methods and vellums that didn't like just all get funneled to the Library of Alexandria.
Well, I was very pro Library of Alexandria before, but now they're just a bunch of bullies.
They were bullies, but they definitely got their comeuppance. They were burned several times. Under attack many different times when Alexandria was invaded or conquered and then recovered and whatnot.
My question is, was the library itself purposely burned, or was it just burned as part of a greater attack on the city?
At least twice, attackers are credited with burning it on purpose. Caesar set fire to his own ships as a defensive mechanism during the invasion of Alexandria, and those ships caught houses on fire. Well, probably what it was is they used it to block the harbor. Hmm. Like, that's a really old trick for seafaring wars.
Because you don't want to go anywhere near a burning ship.
And also, when you sink it, it fills up that part of the mm-hmm. alley, so they cannot come in without wrecking themselves on the ship that's now submerged.
Enough, yeah.
Right. So he sank the ships by lighting them on fire, and it caught some houses on fire. Now, later he is credited with that burning the library. But it took so long for anyone to write that down, and so few of the other accounts even mentioned that that was a thing, that even if it were an actual fire, it would have been it was an accident, but it's really the one that called the library off. It's the one that really just sank the whether or not the library existed anymore.
So they didn't try to recreate it after that.
Right. Well, and they did. They did recover a lot of things. You know, they had a list of the materials after the first fire. They made a list of all the materials that they had, but then that burnt.
Make backup copies, people.
So that one burnt when around the same time as the fire from that Caesar's credited with causing. And which I think is just really strange, because there's no clear history that says he lit these ships on fire and the library caught on fire and that's what did it. They all happened around the same time. But no one ever says, yeah, he set fire to the library by on accident and it burned down. Which probably wouldn't have been the most popular thing to have written, considering he was in the city. But he's credited with that damage, but it could have been any number of other sabotage or carelessness. Because, you know, they didn't have electricity. There was lots of fire inside that library to light everything.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it was only the last, you know, since electricity started that... burning stuff down was not a regular way of things.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff got burned down accidentally all the time.
Mm-hmm. And because they used wood and plant-based construction materials for the shelves and things, it just... You might be on the coast, but you're still in Egypt. It's still pretty dang dry and tender. I couldn't even imagine trying to maintain a library in a desert where the only source of light is fire.
Yeah.
I would be terrified to let anyone in.
Yeah, and a lot of things back then probably faded in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to protect the works from the sun, so you probably didn't have a lot of window openings, which meant you needed more lanterns and candles.
And windows, then, they didn't have rubber seals. They didn't have plastic flashing. So if it rained, water came in through the windows. So they just didn't have windows in large sections of it because it would damage the books and scrolls. Because
it does sometimes rain in Egypt.
Yes, especially on the coast. Yeah, coastal storms. But yeah, so I just think that's crazy interesting because for 20-something years, I thought that the Library of Alexandria was intentionally burned as a war tactic, you know, to lessen the morale of the city to conquer it. But it was after they were already in the city, and it burned several times by over a couple of centuries.
Yeah,
and
I thought
it was just lost in stages.
I thought it had only been, like, I thought there was one fire of Alexandria.
Right.
That there was this grand library, and then this big fire, and then it was all gone and not rebuilt. So
yeah.
I'm glad to learn something different.
So it was a royal library, and then that's where they got the rights to, like, confiscate books and
things,
right?
Yeah, I was going to say, that explains a lot, you know. You don't have just a regular library where they can just grab whatever they want. It takes a decree from the...
Right.
The head sultan or whatever.
It would have been the king of Egypt.
King. So the king said,
hey, build me a library.
Build me a library, and I want copies of everything that's humanly possible.
Yes.
And so they had the right, because you're landing in their kingdom,
mm-hmm.
to gain copies. I'm surprised that they would at least make copies for them and give it to them back.
I don't think they wanted a revolt. When people take time to write out papyrus scrolls, it takes a long time, because it's not like writing on paper where the paper absorbs it. You have to have that papyrus laid out, you have to ink it, wait like an entire day, roll it up a little bit, ink it again, wait an entire day, roll it up a little bit. I mean, it just takes ages and ages. So just saying to somebody, we're taking your week's worth of work and however long it took you to study to make these maps, we're taking it, you can't have it back, good luck sailing out of here without dying. You know, you just can't do it.
But we'll make you a copy, you just have to wait long enough for us to make you the copy,
right.
Which we may not try real hard on, and you may get lost on the way home.
Well, and the thing is, they couldn't leave without their materials a lot of the times, because you need your maps and stuff. But also, it kept tourists in the city. You know, it kept people who had to spend
right.
money
right.
there. It's like, well, hello, yay, spend money here.
Well, do we want to go to Alexandria? Well, we better try to lump all of our tasks in one visit, so we'll be waiting on all of our printed material.
Yeah. It sounds like a really rough adventure to me. But yeah, so I was really surprised to learn that it was several burnings over a couple of centuries. The most famous library patron. Who do you think that is?
Well, of course it's Andrew Carnegie.
Yes. Of course. What countries did he establish libraries in?
Oh, I did a very small amount of research on this, and so I don't know the number. Are you looking for a number or the names of the countries?
The names of the countries.
Because there were a lot of them. Like, there's one in Fiji, and they're in Europe, and, of course, the United States, and all over the world, really.
So the complete list includes the United States, the United Kingdom and Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Serbia, the Caribbean, Mauritius, Malaysia, and Fiji. And when he first started building these libraries, he just gave them money to start the library. He didn't give them endowments to fill the library.
So he gave them the money to build a building, a mm-hmm. complete building, or just to start the building?
The complete building, usually. I'm sure there were a couple of times where they wanted something bigger than he was funding, but he had a few requirements. You had to go upstairs to go into a Carnegie Library building to represent enlightenment and growth upward.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there were always some sort of lantern or lamppost outside to represent enlightenment and the light of knowledge and stuff like that. So I thought that was really freaking neat. I'm like, what an interesting thing. His first several libraries were only in places that were significant to him. So he did one in his birth area in Scotland, the city where he was born, and then in Pittsburgh, obviously.
Because that's where he lived.
He did a bunch there. Starting in 1899, he started building them in places where he was not associated with that place at all. But it was grants that people had to apply for. The last grant was written in 1919, and there were over 3,500 libraries in the United States alone. And nearly half of them... there were 3,500 libraries in the United States. He didn't fund all of those. Half of those were built with construction that he funded. So when he spread out, I think he paid for less and less of the building costs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But so the first one was in... well, his first library that he funded was in Dunfermline, Scotland.
Road trip,
yay. Let's go. It was the first commissioned or granted by Carnegie. It was commissioned in 1880, completed in 1889.
Why does it take so long to build things back then?
Lack of commercialized contractors, probably.
Mm.
You have a few builders, they're the builders, and you have to wait for them to be ready.
And they build them better than they do today. These days they'll knock up a building really quickly, but it'll be really crappy building.
Yes, very much. Most of the libraries were unique. They were designed individually. And he had an associate who approved or denied buildings based on his personal taste, whether or not he liked the design of the building.
Like he would look at a plan that somebody had drawn up, not that they built it and then they wouldn't pay for it.
Right. So he would look at the plans that the architect had drawn up, and when they submit their application for the grant to build it, this guy would just say, no, I don't like the way it looks, so I'm not approving your grant. I'm like, holy crap, how much does it cost for an architect to draft all this up, spend all this time, you have to decide on the land in the first place and everything else, and then you get told no because your style is too gauche.
Did he give them guidelines about what changes to make to become then approved?
I don't know if he did that on an individual basis, but there were requirements, and the requirements did grow over time. But they became more and more personal preference, and that was James Bertram. He was a personal secretary, and so all of the stuff came through James Bertram, and he just, if he liked a building, he would approve the grant. If he didn't like it, he didn't approve the grant. And
he's just
kind of a jerk, but I think part of it, his motivation was probably he wanted the legacy of the Carnegie Libraries to be a fine one.
And a standardized
Like up to a certain quality of standard, you know, a certain level of class. And so I still think it's interesting because some of the Carnegie Libraries don't match parameters. There was a Carnegie Library where I grew up, and it just looked like a building that somebody had put up. It wasn't grand. It wasn't beautiful. It was very sturdy, very clean, very well built. But it wasn't like the Carnegie building here in town.
Did they have stairs and a lamp?
They had two steps.
Well, that's something. So how did that get approved then?
I don't know.
Did they retrofit some other...
They may have gone back and redone construction or something. The library was built right next to a creek. So it was actually a historic location they put the Carnegie building on, because that creek was the first water source that they found that was open flowing for like 300 miles.
Mm-hmm.
They were always getting their water from rains or ponds and things that just weren't holding their own water and were just holding a little bit of water.
And this was what town?
Prairie Grove, Arkansas. And so there's just this little creek there. It's open flowing and it's protected. There's a gate and you can look down in it, and the water table is literally like 5 feet down. In the whole town, the water table is that high, and it's just like, holy smokes, no wonder they moved here. people settled there like crazy, but the library is like maybe 15 yards from the protected opening.
Okay, so how did these libraries fill themselves with books if only the building was paid for?
Well, four of them, including the one in Pittsburgh and the one in Scotland where he was born, though there were four of them, he completely fitted. He paid for everything, including the books, training a librarian, the works. But the rest of them, when somebody applied for the grants, they had to show that they could get the books and get employees in there to maintain and curate and all this stuff. So part of the application process was, how are you going to make this into a library, not just a random building?
So they probably had to get some donations Or commitments of donations of money or books from places,
mm-hmm.
and then also have city budget to pay for
right.
employees, that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
So the cities themselves, or the counties, had to commit to taking care of that building. And that's, Arizona has, what, like half a dozen Carnegie buildings. But the Carnegie building, which is downtown in Phoenix, when you refer to the Carnegie building down there, it is gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. It's one of the prettiest buildings I've ever seen. It's on Washington, so it's literally in the middle of downtown. Beautiful lawn, beautiful upkeep. They maintain everything, and it's all the original styling.
Is it still
a
library?
They've never remodeled. It is. It is a law library, and they teach a lot of conferences there. That's the only reason I've ever been there is for conferences. But there are still books, and I remember the last time I was there, I noticed the self-help section that was really interesting. I'm just like, wow, that's not what you expect to see in a
law library,
but it was pretty cool.
So is it a publicly accessible law library? Because
yeah, I wandered in. Nobody asked why I was there. I just showed up to my conference. You know, I didn't have to pay anything because it was a training.
Well, it's interesting because we live in Prescott, Arizona, and our Carnegie Library is no longer being used as a library. It's got private offices in it. And the public library is just a couple blocks away now. So I'm wondering if there was some kind of a time restriction, like you had to keep it up for a certain number of years or something like that, and then you're allowed to move on.
Considering the last one was built in 1919, I don't think that was a concern for them, because people didn't have enough money that they were just going to build a whole new library. You know, this is a commitment that a community made.
Right.
For the duration of their community. Most places didn't get new libraries until the government initiated workforces. But a lot of libraries became federal property. And the government went through and said, okay, we're going to pay for more books and stimulus and whatnot. And they built new libraries in places that didn't have them.
And bigger libraries.
Bigger libraries in places that had very small ones. Like Prescott's is tiny. I mean, it's the size mm-hmm. of an office building.
But
for a small company.
You know, Andrew Carnegie was a pretty forward-thinking guy, so he had
yes.
to have anticipated the towns and cities outgrowing the smaller
very
libraries.
Much, very much. So, some of my favorite buildings look like small castles. They're just gorgeous. They've got great cornices and decorations, towers, really tall, beautiful windows. The Govan and Crosshill District Library in Scotland was built in 1906, and it looks like a historic building. It is. It's got presence and character, and it's like, hoo-ha, library.
And it looks like it was built much earlier than 1906, is the point I think he's trying to make.
Yes. But it's built in such a way that it looks like it fits an aristocracy. You know, it fits a culture where people expect finery from their functional buildings.
It's fine in quality, but not ostentatious. Like, it's not huge. It's a small, functional building, kind of
yes.
like ours in Prescott. It's not a large building. But
it's tasteful and
it's
effective.
Yeah, it's got like three stories, and at least one of them's underground, and it's a little square thing that functions with pretty windows, and there you go. I'd love to live in that.
I've actually considered, you know, how do we obtain a Carnegie Library building to become a house?
But we can't afford it.
Most places consider them a historic landmark.
Right.
And so even if you do manage to own it, you own at least. Almost, you know, it's really hard to sell it to another person instead of back to the city or county that owned
right.
it in the first place.
And you couldn't make any significant changes that...
Right, you can't remodel most of the time because it's a historic building. And while you might be able to change the decor and, you know, maybe knock out a wall and replace it if there's something really wrong with it for, you know,
structural
reasons. Or, you know, if you need to repair the building, I'm sure you'd have no problems doing that. But you'd have to apply for a grant and a license.
Yeah, that's a headache we wouldn't want.
Yeah. I would much rather buy a closed public school building.
Yes.
Okay, on to Obscure Awesome Trivia. OAT, our weekly section where we ask you a question, you send us an answer, and if you're the first one to answer correctly, we feature your answer on our next podcast. Last episode's question was... What is the oldest stock exchange? What was the first stock exchange in the world? Established in 1460. The answer we got was from Zach. And Zach had a really good answer. in which he pointed out that there is some contention about what constitutes a stock exchange, and there are varying dates, and they're a bit contested. But to my research and information, the correct answer is Belgium, and he gave that answer, so go him. But in 1460, under the rule of Philip the Good, the first stock exchange was established in Antwerp, Belgium. And they sold and traded financial securities, primarily in the form of bonds. They didn't have something like the stock market, per se, but they did handle the exchanges
traded,
of...
Traded exchanges and mm-hmm. things like that. So, congratulations to Zach, being our first ever OAT answer winner. And he would like us, because we would like to shamelessly plug whatever our winners would like us to plug, he would like to draw attention to the charities of the Desert Bus and Child's Play Charities. So look those up on the internet and give it a look for Zach.
Huzzah!
Huzzah!
For episode 2, Obscure Awesome Trivia, Jenny has come up with her own question.
Okay, since we're talking about libraries, let's revisit the Dewey Decimal System. The Dewey Decimal System was first published in 1876 by Melville Dewey when he was just 25 years old. Where would a book about the Dewey Decimal System end up in its own system? Please give us as close to a full call number as possible, please. The first person to send us the correct answer to bristolbanterpodcast@gmail.com will get a mention in the next podcast.
So that's it for today's show. You can find us on the Geek Dad Podcast Network as well as on iTunes and Stitcher. If you have any topics you'd like us to cover or questions you'd like us to answer, please write us at bristolbanterpodcast@gmail.com. As always, we strive to ensure that all of our information is accurate, but we are human. So if we mess up, let us know, and we'll correct the information on our next episode. Tune in next time.
Bye. Bye.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.